You are listening to a sermon recorded in 2006 at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you all for putting up with a whole book of the Bible in one service. I think it's rare that we get a chance to take an entire text that was meant to be a unit and study it together. And you get a different perspective on it when you see it as a whole instead of those little chunks the way we usually do. And I'm delighted that we get a chance to do this. This was originally planned as a two-sermon series. As you'll notice in your bulletin, it says next week I'm speaking on Ruth again. But it turned out that I was able to structure it as all one sermon. So next week I'll pick something different to speak on. I have some ideas already, but note that, we won't be doing Ruth next week. As I said, I originally chose the book of Ruth after Donna Stewart's talk last month on Tamar, who posed as a prostitute and seduced her father-in-law, Judah. She was one of the four women listed in the genealogy of Jesus. And the remarkable thing about all these women is that they each had unusual or scandalous stories, something that made them be kind of not one of the normal, sort of outcasts in a way. Mary there was a scandal about Mary because she wasn't wed to her husband. And then there was Tamar, the prostitute. And there was Bathsheba, who had an adulterous affair with David, and then Ruth, who her claim to infamy is that she was a foreigner, and I don't think I've ever heard a sermon about her actually, but she was a Moabitess, and the Moabites were enemies of the Jews and a snare to them. That factor in Ruth's identity will reveal a lot to us about God's grace, but I'm getting ahead of myself. There's a lot more to be discovered in this narrative, and I'm going to approach it through its literary genre in order to show how the rhetorical elements of a biblical text, such as parallelism and symmetry, can help us unpack its theology. As we go, you will be referring a lot to this little handout that I prepared for you with the whole text. And then on the back, I've put an outline that shows very graphically the structure of the passages, and I'll refer to that as we go, so keep that handy. The book of Ruth has long been cited as a perfect example of the art of telling a story. Its genre is typically listed as short story or novella. It is masterfully put together. If we look at the book structurally, we will see that it is made up of four episodes, which correspond to the chapters in our English Bibles. In the first episode, Naomi goes to Moab with a husband and two sons and returns to Judah bereaved, but accompanied by her Moabite daughter-in-law, Ruth. In the second episode, Ruth meets Boaz while gleaning in his fields, and he makes sure she is well taken care of. In the third scene, Naomi hatches a plan to get Boaz to notice Ruth, which Ruth carries out. She meets him at night on the threshing floor and asks for his marriage in the customary way. Asks for his hand in marriage in the customary way. In the last episode, Boaz offers the closer kinsman his first right of refusal, but the latter turns it down. So Boaz marries Ruth, and she bears a son who becomes the next in a line that will lead to David. Look now on the back of the handout at this outline, which shows the structure within each of these episodes. In Hebrew narrative, whenever a story has this kind of structure, where, let's look at, say, chapter 1, there's an A and a symmetric A prime at the end. It's kind of like bookends. And then the next little section is B, and it's matched by a B prime that has a parallel theme, and D, etc., so on. So it's this kind of mirror image structure. When an author in a Hebrew narrative does that, he's drawing our attention to the central pivot around which the symmetry is formed. And that line in the middle is the one that contains the key point of the passage. So if you're reading Hebrew narrative, often look for these symmetries, and it'll draw your attention to where the key point is, usually. And when the structure is a parallelism of the form in chapter 3, where you have, instead of mirror images meeting towards a central point, you have A and then A prime, B, B prime, in sort of a parallel stepped symmetry instead, in that case, the key lines are the last line of each of those progressions. And more often, it's the prime line. It's the latter of the two innermost indented lines. So arranging the verses in this way reveals some key passages, which I've marked in boldface in this schematic outline. Ruth's pronouncement in chapter 1, verses 16 to 18, with its central sentence, "Your people will be my people, and your God my God," is one of the most beautiful and important utterances in the book of Ruth. This brings out one of several themes in the book, that of Gentile inclusion in the people of God. Ruth is a Moabitess, and thus a foreigner to Israel. She is well aware of that status and expects to be rejected because of it. In chapter 2:10, at this she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" The law of Moses had proclaimed that no Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord, even down to the 10th generation. That's from Deuteronomy 23, verse 3. Yet Ruth leaves her own people and gods and is now warmly welcomed into the people of Yahweh. Perhaps it is no accident that the genealogy in chapter 4 lists 10 generations. It emphasizes that this story is an exception to the norm that the Israelites were used to, that people would be rejected down to the 10th generation. And God was intentional and graciously transcending the law. Ruth's adoption into Judah is part of the rich reward from God that Boaz had anticipated for her. And then that's in chapter 2:12, where he says, "May the Lord repay you for what you have done." The structure of the book also points to a more important theme, that of chesed, the Hebrew word which means kindness or loyal devotion. When chesed is used of God, it signifies grace. And when it is used of humans, it implies devotion. One way the narrator of the book of Ruth highlights this motif is through comparisons and contrasts. Looking at chapter 1, 8 to 14, alongside 4, 2 through 10, we see Orpah and the kinsman, the other kinsman, not Boaz, playing analogous roles against Ruth and Boaz, respectively. Orpah says first that she will go with Naomi, and then she changes her mind. The kinsman first says he will redeem the land, and then he changes his mind when he finds out that marriage is part of the deal. This is in contrast to Ruth, who won't budge from her resolve to stay with God's people, and Boaz, who keeps his promise to redeem. Ruth and Boaz are also compared in verses 3:5 and 3:11, where they each promise to do what is asked of them. "I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. And then in 11, "And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask." These comparisons and contrasts serve to highlight the exemplary chesed of Ruth and Boaz. In the pivotal verses of chapter 2, Boaz praises Ruth for her loyalty to Naomi and for coming to take refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. He later refers back to this as an act of chesed in chapter 3, verse 10. This is Boaz speaking. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier," he says. Boaz shows chesed by sharing his meal with Ruth and by protecting her and ensuring that her gleaning will be successful. Naomi's adulation of Boaz in chapter 2:20 mentions his chesed. This kindness obviously goes beyond that shown to Ruth in chapter 2:14 through 16, as it extends to the dead as well. Ruth's dead husband, her former husband. And in the climactic verses of chapter 3, Ruth and Boaz demonstrate their chesed to each other. Ruth asks for Boaz's hand in marriage in verse 9, a request which he immediately praises as chesed. In verse 15, Boaz continues his kindness to Ruth by giving her 6 measures of barley, a token of his intention to marry her. While the chesed of Ruth and Boaz is the subject of the central two chapters, It is really God's chesed, which pervades the whole story, and is both the framework for and the reward for human chesed. That is made clear by a pair of bookends, which in narrative theology is called inclusio, bookends around the whole book, chapter 1, verse 6, and chapter 4, verse 13. Look at 1:6. It says, "When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there." And verse 4:13 says, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife." Whoops, wrong one. No, it is 13, yeah. "And the Lord enabled her to conceive." So both of these verses that are bookending the entire book of Ruth tell of God's divine intervention in ending the famine and in bringing a son to Ruth, and thus to Naomi. In both cases, God's action ended an emptiness that was experienced, restoring someone or some place to the condition worthy of their name. The name Bethlehem means house of bread, but ironically, there had been no bread in Bethlehem during the famine. So God's provision mentioned in verse 1:6 is that he brought food back to Bethlehem. And then the name Naomi means pleasant, but she had seen bitterness in her bereavement, and so when she comes back, she says, "No, call me Mara," which means bitter. And so her sadness, sorrow, was filled in the end by the son. The story is likewise framed by God's chesed in another way. Naomi's prayer in chapter 1:8 that Yahweh would show chesed to Ruth by granting her rest in the home of another husband is answered in 4:13 when Boaz takes Ruth as his wife. The narrator is implying that God's grace is responsible for the happy conclusion. The attribution to chance in Ruth's encounter with Boaz, chapter 2:3, as it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, sort of implication of chance. But that indicates that it was not Ruth's machinations, but providence at work. God's chesed as a reward for Ruth's chesed functions through Boaz's chesed. The narrator reveals that in his play on the word kanaf, which means both wings and a corner of a garment. In chapter 2:12. "May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And then in chapter 3, verse 9, Ruth says to Boaz, "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." That word wings and corner of garment is the same word in both places. The context in 2:12 even suggests that this is related to God's recompense for Ruth's chesed. Another literary point to Yahweh's chesed being active throughout the book is the refrain repeated frequently with slight variations. "The Lord be with you, the Lord bless you," in chapter 2, verse 4. "May the Lord repay you," in chapter 2, verse 12. "The Lord bless him," chapter 2, verse 20. "The Lord bless you," chapter 3, verse 10. And finally, "Praise be to the Lord," chapter 4, verse 14. One of the techniques that often reveals a key theological theme is the use of a word repeated meaningfully throughout a text. This is known for all you German letters as a Leitwort, keyword. In the book of Ruth, one such word, remarkable for its frequency of use, is ge'al, which means to redeem or to be the next of kin, or in its noun form, goel, which means kinsman redeemer. And it occurs in its various forms 23 times throughout this book of Ruth. The plot involves Ruth's need to find a kinsman to redeem the land of her dead husband and father-in-law and to marry her and continue the line. And Boaz plays the part of the kinsman redeemer. There is also the unknown kinsman who declines his right to redeem. Redemption is one of the themes of the book of Ruth, and it is broader than just the legal custom of a next of kin redeeming the land of a dead relative. By implication, Yahweh is also the Goel who protects Ruth under his wing, redeems Elimelech's clan from the brink of extinction, and turns Naomi's emptiness, mentioned in chapter 1, verse 21, into fullness. As the townsmen recognize, God is the one who provided the kinsman redeemer. The final theme I will point out, and the most significant one, has to do with the genealogical appendix in chapter 4, verses 16 to 22. This is the theme of the advent of David, and specifically God's directing of a relationship that leads to the birth of David. And inclusio, which is these bookends again, hints at God's involvement in bringing the future king of Israel into existence. The book opens with Elimelech, whose name means "my God is king," and it ends with David, the king of God's choosing. This repetition of the last three steps in the genealogy leading to David, chapter 4, 17 and 22, mentioning Obed three times, emphasizes the importance of this ancestry, that this child Obed, and by extension his descendant David, is a gift from God to all Israel and not just to this humble family, is marked by the fact that the women, not Obed's parents, give him his name, a situation unique to Ruth in all the Bible. The name Obed means servant, and indeed he will be a servant of God in bringing forth the future king of Israel. Another inclusio opens and closes the story with mention of Bethlehem, chapter 1:1, and closing with 4:11. And Bethlehem, as we know, will be the city of David. The theme in Ruth, which has the most bearing on the overall message of the Bible, is that of redemption. Yahweh is the Goel, or redeemer, in many passages throughout Scripture. I won't list them all, I have them in here. But one of the phases in God's redemptive plan is this episode in the lives of an Ephrathite and a Moabitess, which leads to the birth of David. It is probably not accidental that a name which is derived from the same root as Goel, namely Igal, meaning he redeems, appears in David's line of descent in 1 Chronicles 3:22. But, of course, the ultimate proof that David is part of God's scheme of redemption comes in the form of his descendant, the Savior, Jesus Christ. There is a deeper significance in the story of Ruth and Boaz than their place in the ancestry of the Messiah. Boaz himself is a type, or a foreshadowing, of Christ. When you have someone earlier in the Old Testament who then is kind of an image of a future person, that is the technical term for that is a type. So Boaz is a type of Christ. Boaz plays the part of the kinsman redeemer using his money, but Christ buys his bride, the church, with his own blood, Revelation 5:9. Boaz redeems Naomi from her emptiness. Christ redeems us from an empty way of life, as mentioned in 1 Peter 1, verses 18 to 19. Boaz invites Ruth to share bread with him and dip it in wine vinegar, chapter 2, verse 14. Jesus invests the symbols of bread and wine with a new meaning, Matthew 26, 26 to 29. Boaz gives Ruth some grain and she eats her fill and has some left over in chapter 2, verse 14. And Jesus performs a miracle with similar results in Matthew 14. Furthermore, Ruth is a type of another noble wife to come, Mary, the mother of Jesus. Like Ruth, Mary is highly favored, Luke 1, 28. Ruth assumes the demeanor of a servant in chapter 2, 13 and 3, 9. And also Mary accepts her role as the Lord's servant in Luke 1, 38. Both Ruth and Mary are at risk of being thought scandalous. And also Ruth is blessed for her faithfulness in chapter 2, 12, and Mary likewise in Luke 1, 45. Ruth's child will be in the line of David and be great, in chapter 4, verses 14 and 17, and so will Mary's, Luke 1, 32-33. The importance of the book of Ruth for Christians today is that it shows us God's hand in bringing about redemption to humanity through the events and people of history. It also reveals that he rewards faithfulness by showing his own mercy, often through the kindness of other people. It shows us his grace in accepting people who might have felt excluded from the promises in Scripture. And finally, it is a really good example of how you can often find out theological meaning in a biblical narrative by paying attention to the literary craftsmanship in the text.